Hello, and welcome to the Anxiety RX podcast, a show created by an anxiety specialist and neuroscientist, me, that offers unique, practical, and actionable advice to help you understand what anxiety truly is and exactly what you can do to empower yourself to resolve it. I'm your host, Dr. Russell Kennedy, an MD who suffered with crippling anxiety for 30-plus years, and traditional therapy from psychiatrists and psychologists really didn't help me feel better. And I also didn't like being on psych meds. In 2013, after burning out and leaving medical practice, I came to the conclusion that if I was ever going to heal my anxiety, I would have to do it myself. And that's exactly what I did, drawing from experiences with psychedelics and holistic healing, and combining those modalities with my scientific academic background in medicine, neuroscience, and developmental psychology. Here on the Anxiety RX podcast, I offer a distinctly non-traditional and non-medical approach to understanding and healing anxiety. So despite the fact I'm trained as a physician, in no way is what I say and suggest to be construed as medical advice, because none of the ways I use to resolve anxiety has anything to do with traditional allopathic medicine. From my own healing, I've created a distinctly non-traditional understanding and approach that helps thousands of people from all over the world understand and relieve their chronic anxiety. So if you're ready, let's get into today's episode. Hello, 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 and welcome to the Anxiety RX podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Russell Kennedy. As you probably know, if you've listened to the podcast before, I was a physician with a terrible anxiety problem and went to all sorts of therapists and did all sorts of different things for my anxiety, and nothing seemed to work until I found this sort of somatic reference in my body. And that made all the difference in the world for helping me heal. And today I have a special guest with me, a friend and someone I've known for a while now, Ian Abbott, two B's, two T's. In Abbott, I always say with my name when I spell it out, Russell Kennedy, two S's, two L's, two N's. So, and I get a little weirded out when people just spell it with one L. I don't know what it is about that, but it weirds me out a little bit. But Ian is a registered massage therapist. He's been doing that for over two decades. He trained in TCM, acupuncture, he's a relationship coach, and he has a program called the Fatherhood Compass that we talked about at coffee the other day. And I said, man, I have to have you on the podcast to talk about this, because it's such a crisis, I think, for men, because we don't get a lot of teaching and learning as far as fatherhood goes. And there's a whole lot of people out there saying, my father was horrible, my father was terrible. So Ian is one of those guys that's out there trying to help. He has two little girls of his own. And I've always admired his attitude towards his kids and his dedication to them. So I think he's a brilliant influence on parents in general, and I'm happy to have him on the show. Thank you for being here, Ian.
Thank you, Russ. Wow, that's quite the intro. Yeah, I appreciate you having me on and being able to talk about this really important topic. As you say, you're a dad of a daughter. You know how important that is. And I think we all, as you sort of alluded to, we've all experienced the impact of parents who, despite their best efforts, might not have the skill set that we wish they might have. So yeah. I think, you know, I sort of laugh about this, because I think, you know, if we tossed a set of car keys to a 16-year-old and said, you'll figure it out without any formal training, there'd be some carnage on the road, right? And
absolutely.
If you, as you know from your training
already
in medicine,
there is already, you know, when you get a 16-year-old on the street. Yeah.
Yeah. Just imagine. But I mean, same as, you know, you went to med school. Like if we just handed someone a scalpel and said, you know, brain surgery is not that hard, you can figure it out. Just do what your dad did. You'll be fine.
You'll make some mistakes.
There's some problems out there.
Yeah. So what brought you to this
work?
Yeah,
that's how we learn, right?
What brought you? Because you're obviously very dedicated to this. Every time, you know, we've interacted in the last number of years, I mean, your dedication always comes through. So what brought you to this work?
Yeah, well, I think it's like so many other men, as it seems to be, where I kind of, you know, had my classic kind of rock bottom, got divorced in 2017 and became a single dad, and was really feeling like I was overwhelmed and struggling. And I was really fortunate to find the work of Dr. Allison Rees, a counselor here in Victoria, and was able to take and then co-facilitate her parenting work, which she's taught for over 2.5 decades. And was just so relieved because, you know, as guys, I think we're inherently kind of fixers. And when there's a problem and we don't know how to fix it, it feels very disempowering. So to have that skill set or that framework presented, it was just such a moment of relief of like, oh my goodness, there's a right way to do this, you know?
Yeah, because I think we're, you know, we kind of get brought up in this male environment, like do it yourself. You know, you've got to stand up for yourself and that kind of thing. And we kind of fake it till we make it. And we kind of hope that our own parenting was good enough because we will parent the way we were parented. And, you know, I didn't, as you know, my dad wasn't really around as much, or even when he was around, he was mentally incapacitated. So you kind of get this sort of James Bond look at life and parenting as a boy. And it's like, okay, and that's what you frame your parenting around, like what you think you should be doing. And I call it kind of parenting out of a textbook, because if you didn't get something, it's hard to give what you didn't get. Right. So, and how old were your girls when you got divorced? Because they were pretty young.
Yeah, they were 2 and 4.
Wow.
And my youngest is actually 9 today. So
okay, awesome.
Yeah, it's been a journey. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I mean, you know, like you say, I mean, when we talked at coffee the other day, I mentioned this idea of guys getting what I refer to as an emotional circumcision, where we don't intentionally or consensually sign up for this, kind of like separating from our emotional self.
Yeah.
But as you mentioned with those, you were talking about a brain scan of women versus men when they hear complex emotional words.
Yeah.
And how women have a lot of areas of the brains that light up and guys don't. So I think, you know, I've felt for a long time like I really want to understand this world of feelings, but didn't know, you know, where to start. So my work with Allison was really foundational for that. And then I did the relationship coach training at the relationship school with Jason Gaddis, which was fantastic. And just all these little things that bring us back to ourselves. And then as you've talked about, we both talked about, you know, doing some psychedelic work and really connecting with ourselves that way. You know, all these things sort of bring us back to ourselves.
And then how does that reflect on parenting? You know, so how does that, you know, that sort of emotional illiteracy, how does it show up? Because the guys that show up in your group, you know, don't have the most emotional literacy. And I think you kind of over the, is it 6, 8, or 9 weeks? How long was your program again?
8 weeks. Eight weeks. Yeah.
Yeah. Over the 8 weeks, you know, they get more. And you told me stories of like these epiphanies that guys get because we don't get any training in this.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's really one of those things, like what I've added to my course in the last couple of sessions is this idea of growth mindset. Because if we have this idea that our emotional intelligence and our emotional awareness is like, this is it, what we have is what we have, and we can't improve on that, then it's very, very disempowering. And if you can flip that around and go, I just need to put in the time, I need to learn what I'm trying to connect to and spend some time doing that. Because going back to your question, if we don't know how to be with our own experience of feelings, then when our kids have big feelings, we either want to shut it down or move away or whatever the thing is, because our system gets completely blown out.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. Like what I write about in my book is that, you know, you're either in protection or in growth. And depending on how you were raised, that's kind of how your nervous system develops, you know, and so much of our DNA is non-coding. Like it doesn't code for proteins. It codes for things that turn on the proteins and turn off the proteins. So we get these epigenetic changes. So our environment really allows us to either thrive or just get into survival. And I think so many men these days in general are just in survival. It does feel like men are kind of under attack these days. And, you know, men are withdrawing from university. You know, now it's like 40%, 38%. You know, it's mostly women. Like there's a lot of pro-women stuff out there, which I'm completely for. But the flip side of that is that men are getting squashed. And the worst part of that is that men don't ask for directions. They don't ask for help.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's super true. And I think like, you know, from my own experience, you do have this sort of like lone gunslinger kind of attitude that we're brought up with, that if you have to ask for help, somehow you're flawed, right?
Yep.
So, and then going back to what you're saying, like it is this sort of like, you know, like granted, there's certainly been some really toxic masculinity out there, but the issue with that, I think, and I've said this for years, is if we shame that, if we shame those men who are doing those things, they just go underground and it gets worse.
Yeah.
But if we call them forward and we provide them with skills and tools and we encourage them, then we end up creating healthier men that benefits everybody.
To create healthier kids, you know, and that's the thing.
That's
like,
right.
It's so hard. Like I see such a rise in anxiety in our children now. I think part of that too is just this screen phenomenon. Like we're not getting our social engagement system fed or matured, you know, eye contact, tone of voice, prosody of voice, body language, facial expression. We're not getting these face-to-face interactions that, you know, you and I would have got from our peers when we were younger. It's mostly face-to-screen stuff now with kids, and it doesn't modulate or mature that social engagement system that allows us to soothe other people and soothe ourselves. So why do you think it's so important for men to learn how to become a parent?
Well, because it is a skill, and it's not even a skill. I was listening to Andrew Huberman had a woman on his podcast recently named Dr. Becky Kennedy. I don't know if she's any relation of yours, but
I think so.
She's a clinical psychologist, and she's done a lot of work around parenting. And she described this idea of parenting as being like, she referred to her work as Duolingo for parents, right? So it's not a skill as much as a language. Mm. And if we were, let's say, you know, parenting, if we wanted to be good parents, we had to learn to speak Ukrainian. Like, that's not a small thing, right? And it's not something that happens overnight. And you don't just read a book and all of a sudden you can do that. But if you think about parenting as a language, and you can think about listening for feeling words and using feeling words and conversing that way, it's a very different experience. So it does have to be learned. Because, you know, I think like we said at the beginning, like we've all experienced parents who are doing their best, but like my parents were likely in survival mode a lot of the time because their own childhood experiences.
Right.
So there was a lot of, as Dr. Gabor Mate talks about, there was a lot of things provided for survival, but there wasn't as much for thriving. Right. Totally. And that's a pretty big distinction.
Yeah, and that comes back to the protection versus growth. And I talk about earlier on, you know, if you grow up in an environment where there's connection, attuned parenting, you learn that life is about connection and relationships. And if you learn that life is about, you know, trauma and surviving trauma, you learn that life is about protection. And again, your DNA will create proteins that are for more for cortisol and more for epinephrine and more for survival chemicals. And that, you know, it's kind of like it becomes this chicken or the egg thing. It just becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy. So if you are raised in protection, it's very difficult to sort of rise into growth, but we can if we're given the right information. And that's why I love the fact that you've created this course specifically for fathers, because I guess it wasn't around. I mean, you had Allison, who I've met too. I think she's amazing. But again, it's coming from a male perspective. And I think it's so important for men to learn from other men. You know, we learn so much, you know, most of the stuff that's out there that is sort of emotionally kind of learning how to be emotionally literate is from women talking to other women. And we sort of, you know, kind of get the side angle of that a little bit as men. But when we learn directly from men who know exactly what we feel, I think it just sticks so much deeper.
Yeah, I would agree with that 100%. You know, I've had guys that have taken my course, you know, a couple guys are in it for the fifth go round, right? And they just like, you know, we got to keep coming back. We got to keep putting reps in at the gym. Right. But to go to your point, your point you just made, you know, we had a session last Thursday and one of the guys went through this whole process of how he first noticed a feeling in his body. Mm. And then the transition from noticing something in his belly as anxiety or overwhelm, and then noticing how it came up into his chest, started to become a little bit more like anger, and then up into his throat. And then if he doesn't catch it, he goes fully out of his body and ends up out here. And we were all like, that was amazing, yeah. Right? Like that was so cool that you had the self-awareness to track it and to notice that transition and to be able to see yourself in it and be supportive of yourself. And one of the guys said, have you ever shared that with anyone? And he's like, no. And I said, well, how does it feel to be seen in that and to be received this way? And he said, oh my God, it feels amazing, right? Because we don't, as you said before, like we as men, we don't tend to do community in the same way. And there's right. such a power from learning with other men, from other men, to see another man express this kind of experience that's really vulnerable and actually be inspired by it, right? Because that was the feeling I got from all the guys in the room was this is something that is so powerful about self-knowledge that it translates into how we can show up as a parent.
And show up as a man too. Like, I think that's a lot of it is that we don't have these templates. I mean, we get these sort of Brady Bunch ideals of what a dad is supposed to be, you know, and Cosby Show and all that kind of thing. It is this sort of artificial, like, I'm never going to be like that. It's a contrived experience. You know, life is messy. Parenting is freaking messy, man.
And hard,
especially if you're getting your kids part-time. Like, oh my God. I mean, I shared Leandra, you know, from the time she was about six until today, essentially. You know, so it's one of those things, you know, you share time and you don't know what's happening on the other side. As men, we're kind of, you know, you hear all sorts of stories about how men are abandoning our kids. We're not good parents. We're not teaching our kids to be literate. We're teaching emotionally literate. We're teaching them, you know, toxic masculinity. You don't see that so much in women. You know, you don't see that sort of, you know, and I've seen some pretty shady female parents, right? And you don't,
for sure.
You don't see that. So it's like we're an easy target, I think, men in general. And I think men as parents, I think it's just because we're not that emotionally literate typically as women are. Mm-hmm. So we are going to make these mistakes and we aren't going to seek help for it typically because men don't ask for directions. So, you know, it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy is that men feel out of their depth with parenting, for sure, especially, you know, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about parenting girls. I mean, the difference between parenting boys and girls, if that comes up in your group.
I mean, to go back to what you were saying before about just kind of the culture is like, you know, we look at the references we have in kind of pop culture for dads, right? We think of Homer Simpson, Peter Griffin, Al Bundy, right? Like the dad is the doofus who's not really checked in with what's happening. He doesn't really know what's going on. Yeah. And the mom's the one who's on it, right?
Totally.
And that's such a disservice to men because there are some wonderful men out there who are emotionally literate. They love their kids like crazy. And they just want to be there and be present. And, you know, one of the coolest things that I've seen in my group is that one of the dads was saying that as he became better at being with his kid's experience of emotions, his kid went from being a bit standoffish to asking specifically for daddy snuggles.
Right.
And to the point where his wife actually felt a little bit put out because she'd been sort of like displaced by her husband as the go-to for emotions.
Right.
You know, and that needs to be met with some compassion because, you know, when you're changing the dance steps in a family dynamic, you're going to step on toes. But I just think like there is so much space for men to be the go-to as much as the mother is, right? And maybe for different things, but to go back to your other point about raising daughters, like I have no reference point for raising a son, but I know that because I have two daughters and I have them, you know, it's just been me the last few years, you know, I have to be able to be all the things, right? I have to be the person who can be emotionally supportive, physically supportive, all those things. And, you know, to be able to be that level of sensitive requires a bit of work. And, you know, I'm a pretty sensitive person to begin with, which is helpful, but it is a thing. But I've talked to the dads as well. And we've talked about just the, you know, everyone says, oh, it's so much better for men now than it used to be. And I'm like, is it though? Really? Because I know that if my daughters cry on the school field at school,
right,
they'll be fine.
Right.
But if I had a son, I'd be like, how much did you cry? And like, who saw you? Because there might actually be some repercussions, right? Because we're not on the other side of this. Like I don't think, as much as you'd like to believe it's okay for a boy to cry, and I support that 100%, the reality is it's different, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, consciously, you know, we're learning how to be a more, you know, compassionate generation, and it's okay for boys to cry. But unconsciously, where most of our programs are, it's like, no. You know, I think it goes back to, you know, almost caveman era, like the men were the ones that went out and they kill the animals, right? So if you can't be, so no, I used to have this joke about, you know, you can't have a caveman going on like, well, the poor pig, like we can't kill the poor pig, you know, I just start crying. And yeah. He's just going to get brutalized by, and the other thing about tears is, and I learned this from Gordon Neufeld too, is that the tears are adaptive, right? Like tears are a way of actually changing our perception. Our brain's perception changes after tears. So your dog is still dead, you're still getting a divorce, but your perception of those things, even though the external reality hasn't changed, but the internal reality does change, then when we take that away from men, you know, I'm not surprised that they're having a difficult time emotionally. I'm not surprised that they have, you know, 3 to 4 times the suicide rate that women do. It's not a surprise that we're sort of teaching men that they have to go at their own on their own, and there's really no help for them. And there's also a stigma about asking for help. And do you get that in your group from the guys? Like, do they say, you know, it's kind of hard to be here, or my wife made me come? Like, what do you get as far as that goes?
Yeah, I think there's a whole range, right? Like, some guys know that it's in their best interest because, you know, similar to myself, like you can't believe in a tough moment of parenting what just came out of your mouth, mm-hmm. right? And you're like, where did that even come from? But like you say, that's like going back to this idea of boys being able to cry. I mean, yes, maybe this generation is better at it, but we were all raised from people from the previous generation,
right, exactly.
who were influenced by the people from that previous generation.
Sure.
So we're not coming in with these new ideas as much as we would like to think.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, it's a tricky thing to notice. And going back to your question about the guys coming into my group, like, yeah, some of them have been given a sharp elbow by their partner saying, you might want to go do this thing.
Right.
But what's cool is that they come in the room. Like, I remember one of the guys, he said when he first came in, he was looking at the other guys going, what are you in for? Right. It was like, it's like they're in prison. But you know, but once they get past that and they realize this is a safe place to talk about this stuff that is hard to talk about, that we don't get to talk about, there's such a relief of like, oh my goodness, I've been wanting to talk about this and I didn't know who or how, and now we can.
Yeah. So what changes have you seen in the men that take your course?
Yeah, like they're able to show up for their kids differently. They're able to show up for their partners differently, and they're able to show up for themselves differently. You know, it's such a, you know, one of the guys in the course last week, he shared this thing where, you know, again, this is all new. This is like learning a language. So, you know, there's a lag time between noticing the behavior and then noticing it in your body. But he said he came into his house and, you know, he was barking at his kids to get ready for bed because they were late. And, you know, he went in to see his wife and she's like, why are you raising your voice? And he goes, because I have an unmet need that I haven't expressed. And you know, and I'm overwhelmed. And she says, but why didn't you? Oh, yeah. You did say it was an unmet need. And then he said, like, the whole dynamic between them changed because instead of her being upset with him for doing the normal thing, he'd broken a pattern. So now she showed up differently. And he said she was on board to help. And now all of a sudden they're tag teaming it and they're a team, which is so much easier.
Yeah, it's breaking that step in the dance, you know, because parenting downwards to your kids, but there's also that kind of reinforced behavior from how you see your partner parent and how she or he sees you parent. That becomes this sort of mirror image, and you got kind of locked into that as well. Because if you don't know any differently, you're just going to do things the way you've always done them. And then just changing a step in the dance like that is so helpful for the person itself and for their partner. Although, as you said earlier, it can be a little disturbing, you know, when the kids start wanting daddy cuddles instead of mom. Like when mom, because my grandkids are going through this right now too, because it was like mom, mom, mom for the first 2 years. And then it went to dad, Angus. I have a grandson and a granddaughter. Angus, my grandson, is now, he's 4, just turned 4, and he's completely fixated on his dad now. And Leandra, my daughter, is like, you know, emotionally, you know, kind of butthurt because she used to be the number one. Like, no, there was no, when he was hurt, when he was white, and now he's going through this dad phase. And it's just, and that causes some friction, unconscious. Again, this isn't conscious. I think Leander's really happy that it's happening that way. But there is this sort of, well, I used to have this, you know, real connected, warm thing with my son. And now it's kind of like, now he's gone to dad. And it's like, how do we as parents kind of handle our kids? Because kids just say what they mean and they do what they mean, right? And we have these, as parents, we have this, you know, enlarged prefrontal cortex where we can judge and look at all these different combinations and permutations of what's happening and how do I react to this and that kind of thing too. And it's just like, how do you align, you know, the prefrontal cortices of these men so that they adapt to the changes, good and bad? Because there's going to be a bit of upheaval, I would imagine, when they start incorporating this change.
Yeah. And I think whether it's the mom or the dad, you know, we're often operating with these younger parts too, that kind of, can grab the wheel. And so we can be in our prefrontal cortex, but then something happens, we get hurt, our inner five-year-old grabs the wheel, and all of a sudden we're, you know, it's like we go from being a parent to our kids to a sibling. And we're, you know, we're in a fight with our daughter or our son as if we're the same age.
Yeah.
And I think our partners can go through the same thing. Mm-hmm. If they see, you know, if they get shut down or feel rejected, then they're going to, those hurt parts are going to come up, and they're typically younger. So they're going to be more immature.
So what are the things you see most commonly with men? Like what do men come in to your course complaining about? Like, my wife says I got to do this. My wife is pointing this out. My kids are, you know, having difficulty at school. Like, what do they come in with?
I think the biggest one, and I think this is sort of like, a pretty common theme among men in general, is just anger, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they don't want to be the angry dad.
Right.
Okay. They're tired of responding from anger.
Right.
But, you know, like, if you don't have a connection to those feeling parts of yourself, and any feelings that do come up, you keep trying to push down because that's what you were taught how to do, or you weren't shown how to be with the experience, then whatever is there when it finally comes out is going to come out as anger.
Right.
Right. So it's about catching things and noticing them when they're like a 2 out of 10 versus a 9 out of 10.
Yeah.
And this comes back to the body, like you've talked about so many times.
Right. Yeah, it's like recognizing it early. The way I describe it is being on a superhighway, and you're in the superhighway to Angry Town.
Yeah.
And you see the exit, it's like, nope, I'm not even going to take that. So it's like the earlier in the highway you see the exit, the more likely you're going to be able to take it. And so it's really training people, like, what are the sensations that happen when I start getting irritated with my wife, my kids, my job, whatever, like, what's the early sensation that comes in, like the prodrome? What's
that's
the,
right,
before the whole, because once it turns over, once the roller coaster crests the hill and starts going down, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to stop, because a lot of those things are age regressions. So we get into this thing, we age regress into this thing, and now we're an 8-year-old trying to parent our own 11-year-old, and it typically doesn't go that well.
It doesn't. No. And I think, like, you know, so looking at how we as parents are resourced, the same way we want to resource our kids, you know, it's the whole put the oxygen mask on yourself first. You know, Allison teaches this acronym HALT, which is hungry, angry, lonely, tired, right? Which is a great starting point. And with most kids covers about 80% of their needs, right? But there were so many times where especially when I was a new single parent, where I would make sure my kids were fed, and then I would feel out of sorts. And then I'd be like, oh, right, I forgot to feed myself. Mm. So just looking at those ways of asking for support, like if you're in a partnership, how can you ask for support? And I think that's also one of the biggest things that guys struggle with, as you've alluded to already, is, like, you know, if you're parenting, it's a lot easier if it's a team approach. And if you're at odds with each other, that undermines it even more so. But I think what guys come up against so much along with anger is shame, right? Mm-hmm. That if they ask for help, it's shameful. If they overreact, it's shameful. If they don't know what they're feeling, it's shameful. And then the part that's kind of scary for our kids is that if we have a challenging parenting moment where we react in a way we're not proud of, we often go into shame. So we're not even there to repair with their kids, right? So they're kind of doubly challenged. Like they're like, okay, my parent was just scary and now my parents disappeared and there's a, you know, meek 5-year-old in front of me trying to lick their wounds.
Right. So what skills do you teach to help dads repair with their kids after these anger outbursts?
Yeah, I think repair is, you know, I call it a relational superpower, mm-hmm. you know, because if we can, you know, they often say like kids that are apologized to will apologize, right? Like we, you know, we always want to like say you're sorry to our kids when they fight with their siblings or whatever. But the forced apologies never work, right? And it's so much easier with all of this stuff around parenting to model what we would like our kids to do. So, you know, with repair, it's acknowledging that something happened, right? Saying, hey, I raised my voice. I'm really sorry. And then trying to check in with them. What was your experience of that like, right? And depending on the age of your kids, you might have to feed them a few words. Was it scary? Was it, do you feel angry? Do you feel sad? Do you feel confused? And allowing them to express that and then being with their experience of that. Yeah, I bet that was scary. Yeah, I bet you were afraid. Yeah, it makes sense you'd be angry. And then talking about what it could look like differently next time. Okay, so next time that happens, I'm going to do this differently. And then do it, right? I mean, it's not about perfection.
For sure.
But it's about changing the pattern.
Yeah, and staying grounded within yourself too, because that's that whole sort of prodromal thing. If you can see it coming and you know this is going to happen, you can kind of lie and wait for it and you know that you can take the exit. You can take a different path. But so often, a lot of times with men is because the powder keg goes up so quickly because of that frustration, because of that shame, because they were never really taught, men aren't really taught how to deal with our emotions as they're arising. It's mostly, you have to take anger management classes and all that kind of stuff, which mostly take a very behavioralist sort of cognitive approach. But, you know, you've already lost your cognitive brain when you shot into survival in the first place. So why are you trying to draw on the cognitive aspects of, because it leaves you when you need it the most. So it's really like drawing from more of a somatic place, like seeing this is going to come up. I see my kids starting to fight. Like one of them will throw something at the other. So what does that bring up? Like what feeling does that bring up in you? Like, mm-hmm. where do you sense that? It's like, well, there's a tightening in my stomach. Okay. Like, you know, really drill down into that. Is it superficial? Is it deep? Is it hot? Is it cold? As, you know, kind of mm-hmm. airy-fairy and Pollyanna as that kind of sounds, it's like getting into the unconscious program so that you can change it. Because if you don't, if you try and change that unconscious program with a conscious strategy, you're really kind of, the horse is already out of the barn. You have to use both. You have to use a cognitive strategy, but in order to engage that cognitive strategy, you have to see it coming. Like once it blows up to a certain point, you don't have your rational brain. You don't have that ability. And this is one of my issues with anxiety with CBT is that you don't have the rational brain there to kind of talk you out of it. So you have to develop this thing. And one of the things that the common things that I'll use is the example of military pilots. What they'll do is they'll put them in a room, they'll give them a deck of cards, and they'll slowly start sucking the oxygen out of the room. And some of them will get a headache, some of them will get like sinus pressure, some of them will get nauseated, and they say, this is your tell.
That's right.
As soon as you get this, you automatically, like spinal cord reflex, you flip your oxygen mask off. Because after the oxygen drops so low, you lose the ability to actually see that you're becoming more and more hypoxic. So it's like, it's just like a spinal cord reflex. You have to see it very early and then you can change it.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what it is, right? We, you know, from the training that you've done with somatic experiencing and I'm in the middle of right now, understanding which part of that polyvagal spectrum you're in, right? Like, are you, I mean, if you're starting to flip your lid, you're not in ventral anymore.
Right.
But are you in fight or flight sympathetic, or are you actually starting to go into dorsal and you're starting to shut down, right?
Right.
And knowing the difference between those as well, and we talk about that in my course, and I think that's such a valuable thing for people to understand about themselves and their kids, because you know, we're going to react differently if we're in sympathetic versus ventral, where we're engaged socially, we're actually curious about what's going on. Because so much of what we struggle with as parents is that our kids' behavior doesn't fit into the social norms that either our culture has specified or that we grew up with.
Right.
But if we can actually see their behavior as communication, you know, so when I first learned that, I was like, oh, well, now I actually have to pay attention to the behavior and try and be curious about what's underneath the behavior and what they're trying to communicate to me.
And what that behavior cues in me. Right.
Like, exactly.
Because it's the old, you know, if you see, you know, I remember once Abby, my granddaughter, threw a truck and rang it right off Angus's head. And it was just, but the look of horror on her face as she did it, because it was like, here's an unconscious human being throwing something, and here's a little boy being hit in the head. But just the look on her face of horror when she did that. And then, of course, they both burst into tears. And it just, I think, I don't know what I was getting at there, but I think it was something about Micah, their father, was able to stay present in that. And then later on, we talked about it, and it was kind of like, this is what happened. Like when I was younger, he had two brothers and that kind of thing. So it just triggers something in you, exactly mm-hmm. the same thing, right? So you just go unconscious because you don't have, men don't have any training in it. Not only don't we have any training in it, it's kind of, we're kind of shamed for needing the training in it. So it all wraps up into this thing where we're these sort of, you know, blobs of emotion, and we don't really have any way of understanding it before it goes bad.
Yeah. But again, if you can understand that a lot of a kid's behavior is simply communication, like it's not like if they steal stuff, it's not that they're destined for a life of crime.
Right.
If they're picking on their brother, they're not going to go to jail for assault. Like they're just expressing behavior. Mm-hmm. And then separating the behavior from the personhood, I mean, this is where we get our kids into that shame loop as well, is that if we conflate what they're doing with who they are, then they go into shame, right? And they can't, you know, when you're in shame, you're fully in dorsal, so you're not going to listen. You mm-hmm. can't hear anything that's going on. Yep. Whereas if you can say, hey, what you just did is not okay, and I love you, but we need to talk about what just happened.
Right.
You keep parsing that apart, and that's an important part of how kids don't assume that they're a bad kid, right? Because they've spent enough time, they've had enough reinforcement of like, behavior is this, I am this, right? I am lovable, the behavior, not so much.
Yeah, and separating that early, because that's another bit of emotional intelligence that we also don't get as kids. You know, we're raised in an environment where there wasn't a whole lot of awareness around it too. You know, you separate the behavior from the child, and it's the old Brené Brown thing, you know, like guilt is I did something bad, and shame is I am bad. So you're not even going to want to touch that. And then that goes double for men, you know, because then you mm-hmm. throw in all the crazy sexual stuff that men are blamed for, probably rightly so in many cases. But just mm-hmm. all of that shame that gets thrown in there, shame is probably the most destabilizing emotion that we have. And we're not really showing men how to process that shame. In fact, we're kind of blaming them for it. And of course, like what you said earlier, when you blame somebody for shame, it just drives it deeper.
Yep. Yeah. And then also, as you said too, right? Like as much as I want these dads to understand that their kids' behavior needs to be separate from the kids' personhood, so does the dads.
Absolutely.
Right? Like if a dad has a bad moment, you're not a bad dad. You're a good parent having a bad moment. You know, like even separating that part alone can really take the weight off a guy's shoulder, and it allows them to stay out of that dorsal, you know, nervous system response enough to still be present and to process what just happened.
And do that over and over enough to see, like I said earlier, the prodrome. So it's like, oh, this is how it goes. This is where this is going to go if I allow myself to go into shame, if I go into even shutdown, this is where it's mm-hmm. going to go. So can I stay present? Can I put my hand on my chest? Can I do some breath work? Can I bring myself into the moment? One of the things that I suggest to people all the time is this little mantra that I have is sensation without explanation. So allow yourself to feel the negative sensation, but watch the whole, you're bad, this is never going to change, I need a divorce. Like watch the voices, because the voices are just completely mirroring the alarm sensation that's in your body. And they're probably not accurate. It's just, in a way, it's kind of a little boy in us that's searching for some kind of meaning in this, because that's how we parsed our way through childhood. Is we found some meaning, we stuck to it, and eventually it kind of worked. And I put worked in quotation marks, because you do develop a strategy towards this shame, blame, whatever it is, but it doesn't serve you, or maybe reframe that. It serves you at the time as survival. But when you become a parent, when you become a partner, when you become a spouse, that coping strategy that worked for you when you were younger, and again, I put worked in quotation marks, doesn't work anymore. And in fact, it creates way more problems, but it was the only track. It was the only path that worked when you were a 12-year-old or a 16-year-old. So you still ride that thing until the wheels come off. And I guess that's why people come into your course. They go, I don't want to be on this wagon anymore.
No, and I think, you know, the other part that I think is super important about learning to be a better parent is, I mean, for starters, it's not about perfection. Like there's the famous British psychiatrist Winnicott who talked about the value of good enough parenting.
Yep.
So it's not about perfection. But if we can show up better for our kids, we can learn how to be more emotionally attuned to what they need in that moment, then we can actually do that for ourselves, right? And that becomes part of that reparenting process. You know, as I've become a better parent for my daughters, I am a much better parent to my own inner child now.
Absolutely.
Because I can offer myself the same compassion and curiosity and love that I can offer my daughters, which feels amazing.
Yeah, I'm you know, intrigued by the fact that repair and reparent sound the same, right?
Yeah.
And it's so important. Like, and people have asked me, like, what's the best situation? The best situation is that your kid goes off the rails, has like a blows up or whatever it is into emotion, and that you repair with them. You don't go back into your old thing of, like, say you separated from big emotion when you're family. So you separate from this kid. So the whole thing just cycles on itself.
Yeah.
And being able to, you know, the family that has blowouts and repairs is much, much better than the family that doesn't have any real, you know, sort of ups and downs and everybody's kind of level and that kind of thing too.
Yeah.
So it's the repair. And this is true, of course, in relationships too, like spousal relationships. But with your kids, you can say, look, I kind of lost it there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sorry about that. Or, you know, maybe the apology is not the thing, but, you know, this is something that sort of got away from me or a little bit. And then how can we repair this? And then in the future, when it happens, the kids don't lose their minds and go into dorsal vagal shutdown, because they see that, okay, there is some repair coming. There is a solution to this. And then the more practice they get in repair, the more comfortable they feel in relationship. It's like when I used to give people who had panic attacks, when I would give them a benzodiazepine like Xanax or lorazepam or whatever, I'd give them a couple tablets of that. And I'd say, the next time you have a panic attack, I want you to take one of these and just, you know, relax, don't drive or anything like that. And it would take the panic attack away. And then all they needed at that point was knowing that they had that other tablet with them, because they knew they had something that would fix it. They were able to kind of stay within themselves and go, I don't like this feeling. It's uncomfortable, but I can stay with it because I know that I have something that will fix it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the reasons I ended up doing my training for relationship coaching at the relationship school, is because Jason Gaddis did this podcast on conflict. And he said, did you know that conflict is a way of deepening intimacy? And I was like, that just didn't compute for me at all.
Sure.
Right. Like conflict, for my experience growing up, was like conflict was, it was scary. It was shameful. It was isolating. It did not increase connection. It radically decreased it. And so when I heard that, it was so unfamiliar. But like you're saying, if you have that trust that the repair cycle is part of the experience, then you can have a big feeling. You can resolve, you know, work through it together. And, you know, as parents, we are the emotional container for our kid to help them be with this experience. Because the other analogy that I came up with, and I think this is why men have a lot of trouble with big feelings, is because, you know, we don't trust that if we have the big feeling that it's going to go away, right? Like if we start crying, we're never going to stop. If we really feel into something, it's going to overwhelm us and we're maybe going to die. But, you know, it's like we're circling a toilet bowl. And, you know, we don't realize that all we have to do is go down through the drain and we just come out the other side having gone through it. But we circle it and we desperately try and grab onto the edges, thinking that if, you know, this is where people talk about getting stuck in a feeling.
Right.
It's because you don't know how to be with the fullness of that feeling in the moment and then just go through the other side. And then I shared that with a friend of mine and she said, yeah, and sometimes you grab onto a turd and hold on to it for dear life, thinking it'll save you from going through the experience.
Alone. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
so, yeah, I mean, men are really good at resisting. I mean, Bill Burr talks about that in one of his comedy bits. So it's like, just stuff it down, just stuff it down, just stuff it down, you know?
Yeah,
it's like,
exactly.
It's so much a part of our, and I think it's the reason why men have more higher rates of heart disease. It's the reason why men have more physical issues typically than women, especially cardiovascular stuff, because it's like there is this sort of pushing your heart down, pushing what your heart wants. We're getting a little sort of ethereal here, but you get so used to sacrifice because men in the society, we're disposable. You know, it's just like, that's the way the society has, like, men are the ones that go to war. Men are the ones that, like, I saw this thing on Instagram the other day about they would interview these women or just on the street. It's like, do you need a man? It's like, no, I don't need no man, you know, whatever. And then they interviewed men. It's like, do we need women? It's like, yeah, of course we do. Well, of course we do.
Yeah.
So it is this sort of this milieu now of like, we're disposable, expendable. And of course that's going to bring up some anger. Of course it's going to bring up some frustration. I think part of it is, I think, we all know as men that we are expendable. Like it's just part of how we are raised, and we just understand that this is the way the world works, right? So we try and make ourselves as useful as we can. It's not women that are going out to fix the power lines at 4:30 in the morning when things go down, right? So I think there is that real sense that we are kind of expendable. We are kind of, in a way, second class citizen. There is this male privilege, this patriarchy that is being thrust upon us. And this is the way the pendulum is moving now, is like anti-men. And I think we have to come together. Like, I think we really do. I think men's groups are starting to really rise up in popularity. I think we're really starting to see that we need this support. And, you know, we can't just rely on our girls. We can't just rely, and that sounded very sexist. We can't really just rely on our women to be the ultimate arbiters and soothers of our emotional strain, right? And that's what I love about your work, is that you're saying, look, you know, you get guys together, it's like, this is what's happening. They can all have a chance to say, yes, I feel exactly the same way.
Yeah, and then it goes back to being in relationship, is that if in a family dynamic, the wife and the mother is the one who's always doing the emotional heavy lifting, that gets tiring as well.
Sure.
You know, and if the dads can step in because they have a new level of skill or understanding, and they can be more emotionally present for their kids and for their partner and for themselves, like it shifts so many things, right?
Yeah. And I think it's just understanding that. So what would you say, like the biggest things that men get as they come through your group?
I think it's just a sense of understanding themselves better, right? Because as much as we focus on being dads, we have to focus on understanding ourselves and our experience of feelings and how to connect it to needs. And, you know, like, and we even get really sort of granular about, like, what kind of dad do we want to look like? Because unless you actually write down, like, hey, I want to have these qualities, and then what gets in the way of those qualities showing up? Well, let's reverse engineer this and kind of look at some of those things, because a lot of times it's a lack of understanding or lack of awareness about kids and their behavior. Like, I mean, how many, you know, new dads know that kids don't know how to tell time,
right?
So you tell your kids, hey, we're leaving in 5 minutes, and they look at you and they dutifully nod, yes, of course, dad. And then you go back 5 minutes later and they haven't moved because they have no concept of time.
Right. Yeah.
And unless you know that, then your story is, they're doing something to me. They're disrespecting me. They're not listening. They're not obedient. And it's sad. And then, but I just wanted to speak too, to your idea of like this men being expendable. Like, yeah, we probably end up angry in the end. But I think when I hear that, the feeling that comes up in my body is this deep sadness.
Yeah.
You know, like it's like sad, you know, that there's this pendulum swing that is so like, I understand where it comes from. And yeah. As you said before, like a lot of it is justified based on some really bad actors, but they tend to be in a minority. And we, as guys who are trying to make the world a better place, we're taking the hits just like everybody else.
Yep.
So there is, for me, there's a real deep sadness, especially about men having this cloak of shame because of things that other men have done that they're, you know, taking the hits for.
And yeah, when there's an active shooter, it's never an active gun woman. It's always an active gun man, right?
Yeah.
So there's that. Yeah. We take rape, you know, it's always men. It's just, you know, it is part of our, it's part of our psyche. It's part of like, we sort of take responsibility. We know when something hits the news that there's been, you know, a mass shooter, we know it's not going to be a woman.
No.
So I think, sorry.
No, that's okay. No, I agree with all that. So I think like, you know, guys connecting to themselves and doing that with other men and realizing that they can ask for help, that there are ways to be supported by other men, that being with your feelings doesn't make you weak. It actually makes you stronger. And it also allows you to be with your kids in their big, big feelings more effectively, which, you know, they need. That's what we're there for.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I do think that, you know, we're raised in this atmosphere of competition, men. Like that's what we're... So I noticed that in my own men's group is that it's so refreshing to be in it with a group of guys that are there to support you. Like they're not they're not there to knock you down. They're there to help you in your wins. Like I talk about, you know, how my books have been hired in the UK and the US for a new edition. And they're like, yeah, that's awesome. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're, and then as a man, it's like, am I bragging here? Am I, you know, it's like, I'm so self-conscious about, you know, not trying to upset the apple cart with the other guys. And it's so refreshing to be in this environment where I don't have to compete with these guys.
For sure. And one of the things that we do in my group too, is that when a guy shares something that they're maybe having a struggle with, I always say, if you can relate to that guy, put your hand up just so they know they're not alone in that experience.
Yeah.
And that does a lot too, to realize that like, hey, you know, I had a tough time with my kids. I showed up in a way that I wasn't happy with. And then you get a few hands going up like, yeah, I've done that too. Right. And then you don't feel like you're some kind of monster. You're just like, you're having a bad moment.
Yeah. So if you had to say, you know, the three things that men walk in and walk out with from the fatherhood course, what would it be?
Yeah. I think they walk in with a belief that somehow, as we've talked about, that the women really know what's going on and they don't. I think they walk in with a belief that maybe they are just an angry guy. And I think they walk in with just a general confusion about like, what are all these feelings that come up with my kids and how do I deal with this? Right. Mm. And then when they leave, they walk out with a sense of like, hey, like I don't have this totally dialed, but I'm getting it.
Mm.
Right. They have a greater sense of connection to who they are and what all this craziness that goes on in their body when stuff happens, like, you know, it means something. It's not just this thing that I keep trying to push down. Like I actually can tune into it and be with it in a more, you know, and not overnight, but it's like, I can learn how to start to tune into that and take it as a valuable piece of information.
Right.
And then the last thing is just like, you know, when you can be there for your kids in that way and you see them sort of like move toward you and actually like sort of appreciate or acknowledge that, hey, you were really there for me. And they're not going to say it in as many words, but like, you know what that feeling is. Yeah. And we have those dad wins where we're like, like I got that, you know, like, you know, you got to celebrate those too.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that all makes perfect sense to me, you know, because we go in with this idea that we're supposed to know and we parent the way we were parented, which, you know, maybe wasn't the greatest. And just having the sense that, you know, I'm okay. I'm okay if I go off the rails. Repair is so important. If I repair, just the confidence I think that men get from repairing with their spouse and repairing with their kids. And just this feeling like, okay, I'm not just fumbling around in the dark looking for a light switch, you know?
Yeah.
Is there anything else that like we haven't kind of talked about or covered as far as like, you know, your interaction with dads or maybe your own experience or whatever that that you'd like to touch on before we wrap it up?
No, I think this is so much of what we talk about in my course, just the role of dads in society now and, you know, just the shifts that are happening and the fact that those shifts have to be conscious. They do much better. I'll put it this way. They do much better if they're a conscious effort to show up differently. And, you know, I think conscious parenting just makes for, you know, better kids. I mean, the old adage, like your parents were doing the best they can with the tools they had.
Right.
Well, let's go to like Home Depot and get some new tools. I mean, guys love shopping for tools, right? Yeah. So let's get some tools.
That sounds,
you know, like a hammer is great for nails. It doesn't paint window frames very well. So let's get the right tool for the right situation.
Well said, my friend. So how do people find you?
They can check me out on my website, lifelovehabits.com. I'm on Instagram at lifelovehabits. And they can learn more about the work I'm doing. Right now, my course is only offered in person, but if there was enough interest, I would certainly consider doing an online version.
Okay. So slowly, Life Love Habits, is that what it is?
That's right. Lifelovehabits.com.
Yeah. And I'm sure I'll get Emmy to put the in the show notes and that kind of stuff up on YouTube and people can find you that way and that kind of thing too. So
great.
Yeah, it's been, I've wanted to have you on the show for quite a while. So it's great to be able to actually chat about this and hopefully the women that listen to the podcast who have maybe their husbands who are, you know, maybe struggling with parenting, maybe just, hey, can you listen to this? There's a couple of guys who are kind of knowledgeable in this stress arena and can understand the dad freak out. And it's important to kind of say like, it's okay. Like this is just, you haven't had enough training in this. You know, it's not like you're going to tell someone who hasn't played hockey before and strap them skates and throw them out with the Canucks. Like you have to be sort of eased into this and gain some confidence. You know, like so much of parenting is confidence and the kids pick up on that too. And the more confident you feel, the better of a parent and the more you're going to feel good about yourself as well. So,
absolutely.
Thanks so much, Ian. Thanks so much for being here. And, you know, I'd love to have you back sometime too. So keep doing what you're doing. Thanks.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. And thanks to the work you do. I love watching your show and just picking up some real nuggets. And you're doing some great work. And I'm glad that your book's getting out to a bigger audience.
Thanks, Ian. I really appreciate that. And I guess we'll see everybody in the next perfect time with the next perfect podcast on the Anxiety RX podcast. And we'll see you again.
So that's it for today's episode. Thanks for listening, and if the Anxiety RX podcast resonates with you, consider getting my book, also coincidentally called Anxiety RX. Or you can follow me on any of the social media platforms at The Anxiety MD or my website www.theanxietymd.com. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you the next time on the Anxiety RX podcast.